This is Guardian Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news, intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversation. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
You're now in the Essential Zone, where we seek to be informative, inspirational, enlightening, and dynamic. But more importantly, we seek to be fair and balanced. There comes a time when the game has no spectators, only players. There comes a time when we must recognize that our individual aspirations shape our collective destiny. There comes a time when getting in the game, despite the risks, despite the challenges, regardless of the cost, is simply the right thing to do. There comes a time when we must find our hearts, find our soul, and pursue our purpose for the greater good of all, for country, for humanity. There comes a time when we must manifest our true greatness. Yes, there comes a time, and that time is now. So let's get down to the essentials. The essentials. Serious radio for serious people committed to advancing the national conversation. And good evening and welcome to The Essentials. Welcome to Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. I am your host, Hubert Edwards, and as usual, we are going to have ourselves a wonderful conversation on The Essentials, The Reset. We continue our series, The Road Beyond 50, where we are looking at developments from independence to now and asking some questions as to what will happen after we have celebrated the 50th. Today has been an interesting day. The Vice President of the United States is in town. They have caused all the roads to be closed, and you know, we have been graciously hosting the highest ranking official into the Bahamas since independence. And so it's a historical day for the Bahamas. And certainly we are going to have a historical day here on The Essentials, because we are going to be joined by a lady too, also one who has traveled the world, one who has great insight, a depth of experience from right here in the Bahamas, but she currently lives, resides in Jamaica, as I understand it. She may be able to correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I'm right on that. And so in many ways, for me, this is a great connection, because I'm in the Bahamas speaking to her in Jamaica. She is the Bahamas in Jamaica speaking to me, and so that makes for a good vibe. And so we are going to continue this evening. Last week, we looked at the financial services sector, and we had Dr. Tanya McCartney and Farida Sands, and we looked at the financial services sector, we looked at compliance, and we looked at some broader issues as to how that may impact the country going forward. Today, we want to take a bit of an economic view, but also we are going to look at some tighter issues around gender equality, so on and so forth. And so we have invited the very, very well-capable Therese Turner Jones to be with us today and to help us through the spot. As usual, if you have any questions, if you have any comments, you can send them through our text line 422-4796. That's 422-4796. There will be an opportunity to call at 323-6232, 325-4316, 325-4259. Given the nature of the program, we're going to ask you to be brief in your commentary. Therese Turner Jones is a Bahamian national, and she is resident in Kingston, Jamaica. She has recently left the Inter-American Development Bank, where she served as a general manager of the Caribbean Group. Her purview span IDB operations in Barbados, Guyana, Jamaica, Suriname, Trinidad and Tobago, and her home country, the Bahamas. She's currently the principal consultant at Max Gwen Limited, a consulting firm she founded in 2022. A trained economist, Ms. Turner-Jones has over 25 years' experience in macroeconomics and economic development, with special attention on the Caribbean. She served the International Monetary Fund in senior posts for over 20 years, both as staff and board level. She holds a master's degree in economics from the University of East Anglia, United Kingdom, And she is also an alumnus of the University of Toronto, the United World Colleges, Lester Pearson College. Her publications include a book on Caribbean fiscal challenges. And so, as I say to you, she is coming well qualified, a member of the International Women's Forum. Ms. Turner-Jones is passionate about financial inclusion, gender equity, children, vulnerable communities, and the environment. She's an ardent champion of development issues facing small island developing states and consider climate change one of the most existential threats of our lifetime. A tennis fanatic, she's married to Janice Jones, a former IMF economist. They are the proud parents of three daughters, Bronwyn Huggins, Eleanor, and Rianne Jones. So without further ado, Miss Therese Turner-Jones, welcome to The Essentials.
Wow, thank you, Hubert. Thank you so much. Are you Jamaican by any chance?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Fabulous. Yeah. Yes, I am in Kingston. It's been a rainy day, but pretty muggy. But I'm really thrilled to be on the program tonight, especially on this occasion as we, as Bahamians, get ready to celebrate our 50th anniversary as being an independent state. Mm-hmm. So much has happened in my lifetime and in the lifetime of our nation that I think it's really important that we mark it by having these conversations, because for those of us who have either the experience of working abroad or even, I mean, I started my career in the Bahamas, by the way, at the Central Bank and other places, there's always good to reflect on where we are, where we're going, because in the absence of that reflection, it's really difficult to correct. And I think we, if you look around the globe, you know, the countries that are doing really well, and when I say doing really well, I'm not just speaking about whether the GDP is growing faster than others. I'm talking about, you know, the state of democracy, the state of human rights, the state of women and children, the state of violence against women and children, safety issues, prosperity issues, how countries are dealing with the threat of climate change, which you mentioned as a looming threat, and we're living that in a daily on it. But there are a lot of metrics we can use. How are we doing on our human capital? Are Bahamians really smarter than they were 50 years ago? Do they have more tools to help them make decisions? Materially, I think we'd say we're all better off than we were 50 years ago. But what about, you know, how we treat each other, how we treat the stranger in our midst, how we're dealing with the social problems that have arisen over the last 50 years because our population has doubled. I was looking at the data this morning. In 1973, the Bahamas population was just hovering around 200,000. And now we're over 400,000. So that's something to think about. What is that doubling in the population? What does it mean? I have some ideas about what it means, but I think also we have to think, is the population dispersed properly over our 23 inhabited islands? Have we given any thought to the development of those islands in a way that is appropriate to economic sustainability on those islands? So I think we have a lot to be grateful for. And I would be at the head of the line to say that, you know, the Bahamas is an absolute wonderful country to live in, but we shouldn't sort of gloat in that, because we know that there are also a lot of issues that need addressing. And top of mind, there are quite a few. I think the level of violence in our country is growing at an exponential rate. Why is that happening? We have been dealing with the tourism industry in a way that I think deserves a lot of reflection, because while New Providence is the island can absorb the tourism plant because we have the infrastructure and we've got the labor here, I think we ought to think about, in the context of the environment, whether that's still appropriate. Is that the best model?
Yeah.
I think we need to spend some time also talking about education, but I'm going to stop because I can go on. You to ask me questions. Yeah. I don't just want to ramble.
Yeah, but
thank you so much for having me on the show.
It certainly is my pleasure. And I think we need to start where we must start. You being a Bohemian, you have lived and worked in multiple places over the year. You have a view of what it means to be Bohemian. I just want you to very quickly kind of take us down a nostalgic road. Look back to your childhood up to this moment. And what are some of the pleasurable moments, the memorable moments for you as the country transitioned from independence to today?
Okay, so I'm going to start. Yeah, let me start with my childhood. So I am one of those Bahamians that I feel very fortunate that I have a solid home upbringing. And I say that to say that I grew up in a household where my grandparents were as important as my parents. Both my parents worked throughout my life. I'm one of five children. I'm the oldest. Finally, we're all still alive 50 years later. I'm the oldest. In 1973, I was 13 years old, and I was on Fort Charlotte for the independence and seeing the flag come down. I think I was in a guide uniform. So that also suggests that, you know, we were, as a family, we were involved in social activities that, in my mind, are healthy for young people. So
have we lost Ms. Turner? I think we have in a discussion.
Sorry. No, I just pressed the mute button for some reason. Sorry. I was saying that I grew up in a family where the social life, which revolved around whether it's Anglican Church that we were a part of or just family life in general, was really important. And I think if I think back on those years and what I see happening in some families today, I think our families are not so tightly knit anymore. And my family, extraordinary in that every year at Christmas time, we are all together. And I say this meaning the matriarch was my grandmother and her husband, and they've since passed. But that the Nixon family, this is the family I grew up in, we gather on Christmas Day, and now we're 100 plus people. So my parents, well, my father's dead now, my mother, her siblings, their spouses, the children of that generation, and then now grandchildren, and there are even some great-grandchildren. I'm not so lucky to have any of those, but I have three daughters, as you mentioned. But I grew up in a family that was tight-knit and that really respected family life. Oops, I don't know why I keep pressing that button. Sorry. I grew up in a family setting that was very tight-knit. I say that to say that I think what we're seeing now in the modern Bahamas is that ties with family are not as they used to be for a whole number of reasons. I mean, my mother grew up in Inagua because she trained to be a nurse. The whole family moved to New Providence. And I see that happening in a lot of families, people who live in the family islands. Eventually, you know, children end up in New Providence to get better education. My mother came to go to nursing school. And so she ended up staying, you know, for the rest of her life and bringing us up in New Providence. And I know that happens to lots of people. And of course, at this point in our lives, we always think about, oh, we should do more with Inagua. We should have more family reunions in Inagua. Well, that's only practical up to a point because family gets a certain size, and then there's only so many places to stay in Inagua. And even though we still have family in Inagua, that becomes more and more difficult, but we always have it as a goal. And I think that's really important. So I think, you know, just reflecting on family life, that's been a big change. I was the first person in my family to act from the Bahamas to live somewhere else after I was educated abroad. At the time when I left, which was in 1993, there weren't many of my peers who were making that decision. And I was I mean, I want to say, I think I was a bit of an oddball then in that, you know, people looked at me, including my own family members, "Mari, crazy. Why do you want to live in Washington?" You, at that time, I was already married. I was divorced. I had an 8-year-old at the time. And so we would both be leaving to resettle in Washington, D.C. And I had no, you know, I was in my early 30s. I wasn't fearful of, you know, this new challenge. I just thought I wanted more for my life. I wanted more interesting work. I wanted to work for the IMF. And I ended up working there for 20 years. My oldest daughter was raised there. She had an excellent education. She's now a doctor, a psychiatrist, working and living in Brooklyn, New York. And, you know, the rest is history. I remarried someone I met at the IMF. We have a daughter together. So I think we don't know what the future holds, but I think having the curiosity that it holds something good and that as human beings, we're going to make the best of situations was sort of my approach to life at the time. And, you know, when I look back on it, of course, it was pretty daring because I had no friends. I had no family members in Washington, D.C., and I had a very busy job. So I ended up having to hire someone who would live in with us. And that happened to be a Jamaican person that I had met on one of my trips to Jamaica working for the IMF. And so, you know, my life changed then because I had the support. I didn't have to worry about my daughter if I had to travel. And we made a pretty decent life. And the most important thing is that I continued my connections with home because every Christmas I was home. My family is important to me. And so every big occasion I was home and my family visited me numerous times when I remarried in 2002. You know, I want to feel like almost all of Nassau came to the wedding. I had a good crowd from home that came. We had John Canoe. It was fabulous. So I've had a really privileged upbringing and a solid foundation for my life. And what I've done with my life in terms of my work life is I've tried to give back. It's been an amazing experience to have the opportunity to live and work across the globe. And probably one of the most memorable of these situations was when my husband was assigned as the IMF resident representative in Guinea, which is in West Africa. For those of you who need to look it up, Guinea-Conakry is the first West African country to get independence from the French. Still very poor, but very rich in resources, and the people are absolutely amazing. And in fact, my housekeeper that I have now is still who we hired when my newborn at the time in 2003, Ryan, the youngest one, was a baby. Georgette is still working with us and live there. So I say that to say that we have to keep a sense of curiosity about the world, and we have to carry the best of our upbringing with us wherever we go. And I think 50 years later after independence, I see Bahamians also making that bold step to step out and say, okay, I want to live in Canada for a while, like my niece is doing now, who was recently married 2 months ago, resettling in Canada. But having the foundation of an upbringing that has been rooted in Bahamian values and family life is quite important. And it does make us special. And I think Bahamians are quite different from other Caribbean people. I've lived and worked in Jamaica. I've lived in Barbados and worked in Barbados. I've traveled around the Eastern Caribbean. And while we share lots of common cultural eating and food and you know, beach and our natural environments are very similar. But I think there's something different about our family life and the way we connect to each other because we're a small country. And small countries mean that networks are small and tight. And we support each other when things get tough. And I think that's really something that I carry with me wherever I go.
That's a wonderful background for that. And so we stand on that and ask you, therefore, you know, from an economic outlook, the Bahamas has made significant progress over the years. But how would you characterize it? When you take all of it in totality, not just simply there's been an expansion in GDP. We have moved from whatsoever the number was then to, 12, 13 billion today. We have circumstances where individuals have greater access to certain government services. When we take the overall economic progress, how would you characterize it for the Bahamas? And if you want to wrap that the social well-being of the overall population, then go right ahead and do so.
Sure. So I mean, obviously, on the economic front, the Bahamas is pretty remarkable. No matter how you look at it, it's a very small country. It's a country that's spread out over numerous islands. And, one of the features that I think we often miss as development economists is when you think about a country like the Bahamas, it is an archipelago. It means replicating pretty expensive infrastructure across our 23 inhabited islands. So that's one thing that stands out, that we've managed to do that. And we managed to provide healthcare, and maybe, they don't all have hospitals, but... and my mother was a community health nurse, and my mother traveled to islands over the course of her career, spending time being the nurse on the island. We have looked after those populations, I think, fairly well. But it's expensive to do. And obviously, this have not accrued evenly across all of those islands. So, what pertains in New Providence is not what pertains in Massey-Towne Inagua or in Cat Island, or even in Long Island. So I think that's always going to be a special feature of our development, that we have to think about the family islands as places that also need nurturing and development. Now, I don't think they need the same kind of development that we have on New Providence, meaning we don't want, Long Island, Exuma, and, these places that I love to visit to be inundated with, 12-story hotels on the beach. I don't think that's appropriate for the level of infrastructure. And also, we want to preserve those islands in a way that makes sense for the small populations that there are. So we know that when you introduce a massive hotel property, let's take the first Four Seasons property that went in Exuma, for example, it was difficult for that hotel to get labor because Exuma couldn't provide the kind of labor that it needed for the Four Seasons. So now it's Sandals. Now it's quite successful. I happen to have been at least privileged enough to visit it when it was both. No, not yet, both as Sandals and as Four Seasons. And the scale of the hotel is probably appropriate. But when we introduce something of that scale in an environment where... labor is hard to get and maintain, and they may not be trained in the way that it needs to be for that level of or quality of hotel, then you add additional costs and so on to that project. So I'm just saying that when we think about the development of the family islands, we can't think the model of New Providence where labor is more accessible, infrastructure is more accessible. We have to think about scaling down those projects in a way that it's suitable and sustainable mm-hmm. for those islands. Water is a problem, right? Water is a problem everywhere. So we have to make sure, too, that whatever the right infrastructure. And that's why I think the family islands, as low impact, villa type, smaller properties, that makes sense for the population, also for the infrastructure that exists.
Definitely. But you speak to the issues you just raised, I think are very, very important from a economic development point of view. Because you point to, I think, what one could argue is some of the balancing act which needs to take place when you look at the Bahamas from environmental point of view, the balancing of the pristine environment. But obviously, as an economic model, the Bahamas has been pursuing tourism as the main driver. And given the nature of the family island, given the need for growth, given the limited population center that we have throughout the archipelago, do you see beyond some of the need for additional growth imposing some sort of friction, some sort of tension on the need to change those models to have bit more incursion into those areas?
Yeah. So development, there are a few basic things that are needed, right? So you need electricity. You need reliable electricity that's low cost. Unfortunately, the Bahamas is still fully dependent on fossil fuels. We have not yet advanced in renewable energy. I know we're on that way, and I'm not going to say nothing's happening. But for a country that is on the top of the list for sea level rise, devastation, and possibly eradication if the temperatures continue to rise as the models predict, we need to start thinking about, okay, you know, reducing our fossil fuel footprint and use of oil is not the way forward for a country like the Bahamas, where climate change is, you know, staring us in the face every day. So I think one of the family islands is to think of electricity generation for those islands from renewable sources, whether it's solar, whether it's wind, whether it's something else. And by the way, there's something else. There's so much happening in the field of renewable energy that it boggles the mind how quickly the technologies are coming on stream, whether it's, you know, green hydrogen or, you know, and hydrogen coming from all kinds of other methods. I'm not a chemist, I'm not an engineer, but the more I read about how many sources of potential energy exist, I realize that, you know, this feeding frenzy of fossil fuels is really hurting us. It's hurting the whole world. It's hurting the global planet. You know, what's happening in Quebec with the wildfires is a result of, you know, too much heat too early in a country in the Northern Hemisphere, and what's happening in New York and Washington, D.C. and the surrounding areas with this, you know, it's something that we have to get used to. It's going to repeat itself because wildfires are literally going to become a feature of everyday life. So I say that to say, in the context of the family islands, let's think about a new model. So for the next 50 years, if we had a plan to put renewable energy on Long Island, in Exuma, on, you know, Cat Island, on Inagua, these places, we can now liberate from, you know, the likes of BPL having to do it in a very expensive way and in a way that the average person shouldn't have to pay those high costs for electricity. Mm-hmm. And it's not reliable. So let's really advance on that. It makes sense from a climate change perspective, and it makes sense from a sustainability perspective. I think all of our business models moving into the future have to be seen through a climate change lens, and we have to really think about shoring up our coastal zones because the sea level is rising.
Yes.
And I think Hurricane Dorian was a very, it was an unfortunate wake-up call, but I think we're in store for more of those kinds of events. And we have to really prepare for it.
Yeah, I want to take you down a road, maybe a little bit controversial, certainly in the Bahamas. Mm-hmm. It's going to be controversial anytime you touch on tourism. But mm-hmm. I want to put it to you, Ms. Turner-Jones, that mm-hmm. the Bahamas is at a tipping point, maybe a crossroads, as we contemplate the recent budget. As we look at the challenge the government is having in terms of marshalling its resources, as we contemplate, you know, unfortunately so, contemplate some of the reforms which should have been put in place 20 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, but which still linger, that at some point in time, the government may be, or the country itself, may be challenged to move more into what as opposed to away from, out of necessity. Do you see that as a problem going forward?
Oh, I don't know if I answer, if I get the question. What do you mean by that?
You are advocating for a greener approach to development and growth, yes. a leaner approach on the family islands.
A more sustainable approach.
I
think the tourism model has really served us well for the last 50 years. It's created jobs for lots of people. And at some point in our history, I recall people having two jobs. Now, I don't think we're in that world anymore because we've had so many crises. We had we had the oil crisis in the 70s. We've had the financial crisis in 2008. We've had COVID. And we're just emerging out of this long, horrible period of the pandemic and all the suffering and job losses and pain that inflicted on everybody around this globe. Because we're a tourism-dependent economy, we saw what it's like to have zero visitors come to the island and how the country comes to a grinding halt. But this is what happens when all of your eggs are in one basket. And I know that diversification in resource poor countries, and I call the Bahamas a resource poor country because yes, we are resource rich in sun, sand, sea, and our natural environment is extremely beautiful, but we don't have much else. We don't have commodities that we can sell. We have very little manufacturing that we do. We don't have a huge private sector with endless capital to invest in things that we're not accustomed to. So we have been, as economists say, you concentrate on the things that you can do and do well and where you know you can earn some foreign exchange. Because remember, for everything that we consume, it's not really consumed because we've grown it or we've made it in the Bahamas. The Bahamas is a highly dependent country on importing. Just think about, you know, the phone you're holding now, all the technical things to put a radio program together. None of that is locally made. So there are people, I think, who are out there talking about nationalization in the Bahamas and Bahamians, but to be honest, that doesn't go very far because we are very resource poor. We're very poor even in terms of our ability to do things that are non-traditional. By that, I mean, we haven't educated Bahamians to do things in a very sophisticated way, right? Most of our children are graduating with some literacy, with some numeracy, but to basically do low-wage, you know, unskilled jobs. The Bahamas, I was checking data today, has more tertiary graduates in the labor force than any other country in this region. I didn't realize that until I read this report. It just came out from the IDB this week. But we have a lot of people who've been to tertiary level institutions, but job options are very limited. So it's financial services, it's tourism, it's the professions. So whether you're a doctor, you're a lawyer, you're an engineer, but these are not the majority of the workforce. The majority of the workforce are what I would call average skilled people who can work in hotels and, you know, make beds and pour drinks and serve people outside the bar and so on at hotels. And we have sophisticated chefs, and I don't want to undermine the fact that we have lots of very highly qualified Bahamians working in the tourism field and in the financial sector. However, on average, and this is how you have to talk about a country, on average, the skills are not such that, you know, we're not exactly coming up with the cures for cancer or the next, you know, rocket that's going to do something, or we're not building, you know, iPhones ourselves. So I say that to say that the foundation for a country moving up on, I don't want to use a technical term here, but moving up in the, let's say, the food chain of more sophisticated products that are produced or services that are produced, education has to be a big component of that. And I think we have good schools, but if we look at the results of kids coming out of the, we're left kind of wanting. So it's not that we don't have highly trained people in niches throughout the country, and we've got some of the best lawyers, accountants, and all of this professionals working, but we need to do more than that. And especially since the world now is being driven by technology. So we need to be investing in students who can, you know, code student, well, you don't even need to know coding anymore, but people who can design, technological solutions for whatever the problem is, right? Because that's how the world is working.
But doesn't it go maybe a little bit beyond that from a development point of view, in that because the Bahamas has very limited internal markets, and, you know, as you mentioned, we import everything. At the end of the day, you have to earn your way, and the only way you can earn your way is by exporting. Isn't there an argument to be made?
I wish people would stop talking about internal markets, because they're so small, they're insignificant. It's almost like saying, oh, if only we traded with, you know, the rest of the Caribbean. But the rest of the Caribbean is the same position we're in. We have small markets, we produce very little goods, and by the way, they tend to be the same goods that all these islands produce. And so we're sort of tripping up all over each other with the same products. What we need is more diversification in what we do, make, create, and so on. And here is where there's a lot of potential. We are a highly creative region. Bahamians are very creative, musically, artistically, in all manner of arts and whatever else comes under that umbrella. We can do things that boggle my mind. For example, when I watch a Junkanoo festival and I listen to the music, I mean, I'm just, you know, I'm transported into a different place and time, because not only is it an excellent product, the music is something you enjoy, but the visual is, and the creativity of Junkanoo says a lot about what's in the Bahamian mind, right? And I think that's what we haven't been able to capture. We haven't been able to monetize our creatives. We haven't honored really our creatives very much, because, you know, if your child is interested in art or interested in music, you tend to downplay those things, because somehow in your mind, how are you going to make money doing that? But, you know, we know that in our lives, I mean, globally, entertainment and the creative fields are the growth is, right? Whether it's music or whether it's film or whether it's whatever, there is a lot of potential there.
Definitely.
And I think we need to focus on getting our children in school to unleash all of this potential that we know that they have, but the opportunities may not be there. Yeah. And by the way, creatives, you know, it can also be in a digital format, right? It's not just, you know, putting the art down on paper, but being a graphic artist, being a film producer, being, you know, writing the scripts for film, for films and so on. So there's a whole lot that I think the average Bahamian may not have been exposed to, just because we've put all our eggs in this one basket called
tourism
and financial services. I put the financial services such a small piece relative to tourism. But I think we just need to let our children explore more areas, and we need to challenge them. And, you know, it's always amazing to me.
Ms. Jones, in the political season, right? Yeah.
Some of the creative things that come up in these memes and these videos that Bahamians can put up or something. I mean, that's creativity, and we have to harness that.
Definitely. As we have a call on the line, we're going to take the call right now. But certainly, in broad terms you speak of, there needs to be a greater leveraging of the orange industry as the orange economy, as we call it now.
But, I mean, and it's not just the orange, right?
So yeah. And certainly to find ways of leveraging and better exploiting the linkages between that and tourism. We'll take the caller now. Caller, you're on Guardian Radio, The Essentials. Go right ahead.
Good evening. How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
I mean, I've been saying this for years. This lady is right on point. I just tuned into the show. I'm amazed. I mean, I've been saying this for years. Our educational system is great, but we're not producing the type of Bahamians that we need to produce to take this country to the next level. And I love your show. A lot of people may not listen to your show. Every Thursday evening to come so I could hear what you have to say. And this is the best show you've had from you been broadcasting the show. I'm telling you, this is the best to me.
Thank you so much.
Congratulations, Hubert.
Yeah, certainly. Thank you so much. And that's the only point you want to make?
I mean, but why can't we piggyback off what she's saying? And because This country is so beautiful and has so much potential that it's ridiculous. But yet, we are still a banana republic. Like you say, we think they said we're the richest country in the Caribbean. I never believed that to this day. I believed it earlier, but now I do not believe it. I think we basically a banana republic, the way we carry ourselves, the way our people carry themselves now. Yeah. We're not reaching for the stars like how other countries are doing, you know, Jeff Bezos them and all this other stuff. We're not doing that. And technology is the key, and we're not teaching that in our school today.
Okay. Thank you.
The caller has hit on a nerve, right? So there are many things going on all at once, and economists tend to break things down in kind of dollars and cents, but the ingredients for a country to really flourish is really all vested in the human capital, right? I was looking today at how our Human Development Index, this is an index that the UN uses to sort of give a metric to say, well, how are the human beings in that country actually progressing over time? And to be honest, the trend line for the Bahamas is a pretty positive one. I mean, we've been moving up on the Human Development Index, and Human Development Index takes into account things like healthcare, education, literacy levels, you know, access to water, access to electricity, access to a whole bunch of things. So we have a really strong basis to do what he's saying, which is to find ways to capture more of the human potential that exists in the minds of Bahamians. And I live in a country, Jamaica, where, every day I see a lot of what I call underutilized potential, because Jamaica is a country with extremely talented and creative people. But because so many people have been left behind, either in education or because of their income levels, it's a struggle. And it's a struggle to see how long it's taking for them to turn the corner in terms of building the human capital. And capital by putting in it, you know, the best education possible. And now what do we mean? For example, the World Economic Forum says that, you know, the workers of tomorrow, the 21st century workers, have to be first and foremost digitally literate. So we are now living in societies where those who have access to data and connectivity can move and advance and do things much, much faster than those who are on the other side of that divide, those who can't afford to pay for data or who may not have access to these digital devices the way some families do. And you can see, you know, just look at children when they interact with an iPad or something when they're really young, how it unleashes a way of being, a way of thinking, a way of doing things that their parents may not even understand, but they are put an iPhone in front of even a baby today, and that baby will take its finger and start, you know, putting its hand all over the phone, and sure enough, the phone will light up, and that's the dopamine that we all, because we're all addicted to our phones or our devices, but it unleashes something different, and technology is a pathway for leapfrogging into the 21st century. So there are things, let's go to public services. There are ways that our public services are delivered in the Caribbean that are very high context, that involves a lot of face-to-face interaction with workers who, by the way, don't necessarily want to see you as a client, right? You're bothering them, you're either interrupting their breakfast or you doing something, and when you approach, you know, the kind of service you're getting is not exactly the one you want. But this is how our societies have structured the delivery of public services. Now, in some countries, recognizing that human beings aren't good at that, they have started to deliver a lot of these services online. It's more efficient, it costs less, and things get done that improves the productivity of the average person working in that country. So if I have to spend, for example, an entire day trying to get a transaction done with a government office, that means I've taken away time from what my job expected me to do, but I've been doing it on something that basically there's to have this interaction with the government, whether it's paying my taxes or getting a new passport or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So those kinds of services lend themselves to digital transformation. And I must say, I was very happy that, you know, the last few months when I was in Nassau, I was able to get a passport in 24 hours. Now, it should be that every government service that you need, you should be able to do that. But we know that it's not working at the same pace across the whole system. So this is where, if a country doesn't have the natural resources that some, you know, a country like the United States or even Canada, you know, these big developed countries that are well endowed, not just with natural resources, but they're wealthy and they can educate their citizens, you know, at a low cost. If you're not in that privileged position, then you have to figure out, okay, how do I make this little bit that I have, how can I maximize the returns on this? And take a country like Estonia, 1.2 million people, in the middle of Europe, close to Finland. It used to be a Soviet territory at one point. And what the Estonians decided when the Russians left was that we want to be the best we can be. We want to be like Finland. So we're going to be the best at digital technology. And of course, they're the top of the list in cybersecurity. And everything that you need and you can possibly want to do in Estonia, you can do it. You can do it digitally, including voting. I think the only thing in Estonia that they ask you have to be present for maybe is to get married, that you have to show up at one place face to face to do that. Right. I say that to say, because we don't have all of the, you know, excesses that rich countries have, we have to figure out ways to make ourselves the most efficient, the best at whatever it is that we're going to do, whether it's tourism, whether it's financial services, whether it's the creative sector, whether it's music, whether it's, you know, the next cure for cancer. We should have some of the best labs. We should be encouraging our students to really get interested in science and in medicine and these kinds of things. We have to be the best that we can be. And you can only do that by setting high standards. I think the frustration that I heard in the caller's voice is it seems like things are falling apart. And I know sometimes it feels that way because it's road rage, it's traffic, it's, you know, surliness of people, that it's the kind of social, what I call the social environment around an Iraqi situation, where before that was a pretty family friendly place to be, to go for lunch, to have Kong salad, whatever. But now the average conversation has so many expletives that you don't want to hear that, right? So what's happening culturally? What's happening socially? How is it that we have managed to either lower our standards or become so insensitive and uncompassionate? This is the society we live in. And I think that's his frustration. Certainly. And that's because there are a lot of people who are not realizing their potential.
Mm-hmm. And you made some good points. And so we are going to have ourselves a break here. And then when we come back, we want to talk about some of the other areas. You know, we want to look at, you know, are we under celebrating the progress of the country? Are there some areas which we need to, you know, celebrate some more? And when we talk about growth and development, we have to then come back to the fact that we are in the drive. I mean, if you look at it historically, the Bahamas inherited a model. And over the last 50 years, there are ample opportunities to change that model, to tinker with it, to move in a direction which is going to, you know, approximate what you have been speaking about. And so the power is in the hands of the Bahamian public. The power is in the hand of the leadership of the Bahamas. And consequently, the question is, how do we deal with this when we get beyond the celebration of 50 years of independence? You're listening to The Essentials on Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. I'm Hubert Edwards. My guest is Miss Therese Turner Jones, an economist, an individual who has lived in multiple places, worked at the IMF, at the IDB, now resides in Jamaica, is a consultant in her own organization. And so when we come back, we're going to explore some of these things, including looking at some of these gender issues, an era which is oftentimes misunderstood. Don't move. Come right back.
always on the go? Missed the show? You can now listen to Guardian Radio talk shows anytime, anywhere, on Stube by searching Guardian Radio 96.9 FM or by entering the name of your favorite show. You can also listen by logging on to guardiantalkradio.com and clicking on the podcast tab. Guardian Radio, continuing to provide you with fresh news and smart talk anywhere, anytime, all day.
Next Level Solutions.
Next Level Solutions.
Solutions.
At Next Level Solutions, we assist companies and organizations to understand and strategically resolve governance, risk, compliance, regulatory, finance, and operational challenges, maximize their performance, and grow. Next Level Solutions, a dynamic consultancy built on experiential knowledge. For further details on our service offerings, visit nlsolutionsbahamas.com or call 376-8951. Next Level Solutions, practical delivered.
Love the show? Want to give your support? Become a sponsor today. Call 302-2300 for our rates and packages. That's 302-2300. Become a sponsor on Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
The new Guardian Radio app is here. Listen live to all our Guardian Radio shows and live video stream select programs in our studio. Get information about Guardian Radio shows and our hosts. Send messages, including text, email, and even call. All from our amazing new Guardian Radio app. Download it free today in your App Store for your Apple device or Play Store for your Android device. The all-new and improved Guardian Radio app.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
Aha! Oh yeah! This could bring back some memories.
Welcome back to The Essentials as we listen to the song Bring Back the Good Old Days. Maybe, you know, sometime nostalgically, the good old days are the good old days, but sometimes the good old days need to be the once upon a time days. We need to move forward. We need to sometime rethink programs. We need to rethink strategies. Not lose the morals, not lose the foundation, not lose the ground in which our guests have been sharing with us. But there has to, at some point in time, given a consideration as to whether or not the models that we are pursuing are beneficial. And one of the things which I would have observed here in the Bahamas, and Ms. Turner Jones will help me with this. In many ways, the Bahamas has grown economically. Many individuals in the Bahamas have done well, but there still remain segments of the Bahamas that has remained vulnerable. Really, in many instances, some persons are being pushed to the periphery of society. So there is not a concurrent movement in some of these individuals, and it's generational. It's kind of surrounding families, kind of surrounding eras. Individuals who have become upwardly mobile has moved out of certain communities. These communities are now somewhat depressed. So I come back to you, Ms. Turner Jones. The question is, are we advancing economically on a macro basis, but maybe losing some people along the way, losing some communities, losing some of what represents in the earlier days the fabric that glued Bahamians together?
So I think this is not just a Bahamian phenomenon, but it's a phenomenon that happens across the globe, right? So I don't want to say the poor will always be with us, but I think governments have a responsibility to look out for vulnerable communities. And what do I mean by this? So I talked about the different sort of economic shocks that the Bahamian economy has had over the last, few decades. And in every, you may have been considered middle class, but maybe you and your spouse or your partner lost a job. You may have lost your house, and now you're finding yourself on the edge of survival, right? And in every economic downturn, and I take a community, and this is one I like to analyze a lot, Grand Bahama. The Grand Bahamian, and I know Grand Bahama is a hot topic right now because of all the issues around the Hawksbill Creek Agreement and the Hayward and the St. George family. So let me just put in my two cents on this too. But if you look at Grand Bahama with the shocks of the natural disasters that have been recurrent, it's really hard for some of those folks to catch their breath, right? Because it's not just, there was a dip in the economic environment because tourism was in the doldrums because of, the 2008 crisis. And then, come up for air a little bit, the hotels rebound and people get jobs. And then you have a hurricane, and then you have something else happen. And then you have COVID. And then you have, this sort of very also unusual arrangement between the Grand Bahama Port Authority and the government that is, I would say that leaves a lot of room for debate in terms of who should step in to fill the void. And families are really hurting on that island. I mean, I would say that I've come to like certain parts of Grand Bahama, but I've also come to detest certain parts of it that, and every time I go there, I have very mixed feelings about the place, but it's mostly because of what has happened, whether because of the hurricanes and because of the devastation and because of the shuttered buildings and the houses that have only been half repaired since, hurricane number one and now hurricane number two and now hurricane number three. So it just seems to be an island that hasn't caught itself. And who is really responsible for that? Operates in a bit of a gray area, right? The Grand Bahama Port Authority has a lot of power over almost every economic activity there and how things work. But at the same time, I also find myself when people say, well, what do you think, where would be a good place to put an innovation hub or see some real different kind of activity? And I always think about Grand Bahama because at one point in its heyday, Grand Bahama was attracting pharmaceutical companies from all over the world. And I want to make it separate from tourism because I don't think Grand Bahama, to me, is not the island where I would first run to make it a tourism destination. But for people who have found themselves as a second home owner, let's say a lot of Canadians, for example, have found that Grand Bahama suits them. Great, great, if you find that to be lovely. But I think the real potential for Grand Bahama is what it can offer in terms of diversifying the Bahamian economy. Mm-hmm. And so let's find those businesses, those industries that would want to locate in a strategic geographical location, very close to the U.S. border, where, all kinds of manufacturing can happen there, all kinds of new innovative technological businesses can be located there. This should really be the focus of Grand Bahama, an innovation hub, a university campus. There's something about Grand Bahama, I think, that lends itself naturally to those kinds of activities over tourism.
How do you address the current population, which has a concentration in terms of skill set, which is highly based around tourism?
Well, there's a thing called upskilling. Mm-hmm. And for any new industry that comes in, people have to be trained. I mean, it can be on-the-job training. It can be putting in, attracting the kinds of training at institutions that can scale up skills fairly quickly. You know, it's only 48,000 people, right? I don't know the exact population of Grand Bahama, but I don't think it's 50,000 people. Let's say of the 50,000, the labor force there may be 25,000. So we're not talking about a heck of a lot of people. It's just having in place the right mechanism so that people can retool themselves to do something different. And also think about, you know, the heyday for Grand Bahama. You know, whole families uprooted themselves in New Providence and moved to Grand Bahama. It was the new frontier. I mean, my father's only sister uprooted her 9 children and they relocated to Grand Bahama. They grew up there. Schools were good. Houses were fairly inexpensive. Electricity was inexpensive. Infrastructure was there. These kinds of things. It had everything.
Why?
It attracted families.
Yeah.
And
why
what
did
happened?
It have everything, though? I mean, what was the main driver of that everything?
The main driver
when
was
we have,
economic opportunity.
Just before you made
it was
a point.
It was economic opportunity. It was these new businesses that had come. I forget the name of some of these. Syntex was one. I can't remember the other names of all these places that were there, but there were people working in these organizations. I don't know what happened to cause that model to collapse. And somehow we haven't figured out a way to redress it. In other words, given the strategic location of Grand Bahama, why is it that we haven't been able to attract Silicon Valley firms, for example, to do business in a place like Grand Bahama or New Providence for that matter, or Exuma or anywhere else? Mm-hmm. Because think about, I don't know if you've realized, Hubert, but you know that Miami is becoming the Silicon Valley of the South. It's an innovation hub. A lot of fund managers and investors are looking to invest in the next startup. It's all happening in Miami, which is 20 minutes away from us by plane, very close. We're not into that. We're missing out on that business. But this is really where the growth is going to come from in the future. It's tech firms. It's anything dealing with technology, whether it's fintech, whether it's biotech, whether it's agritech. That's the way of the future. We have the land. We don't necessarily have all the skills, but the skills will come and we can build the skills if we can attract the right kind of businesses. And attracting the right kind of businesses means that the policies have to be clear, right? The government needs to articulate what's going to happen. And by the way, part of having a good policy environment is to have low debt. It because nobody wants to know that they're moving to a country where the debt to GDP ratio is escalating and not decreasing, right? That's a bad sign for any investor. It means you're going to be taxing in the future because you need to pay down the debt. So we need to figure out a way to diversify our economy, to give Bahamians more opportunities, to tap into the creative potential of every single person in the country, and to do it in a way that's sustainable, because we know that we're facing an existential threat from climate change. So we have to shore up our coastal areas. And by the way, that can be a growth industry, right? Planting more mangroves as sea defenses, making sure that we protect our mangroves. And by the way, for those of you who have not, I highly suggest you take this very nice boat tour that goes through some mangroves that'll blow your mind. And that's what, you know, that's what we want to be promoting. We want to be promoting our natural environment, protection of our environment in a way that when the next terrible storm that comes, and we know it's coming, we're ready for it. So you talked about the orange economy, but here we have opportunities with the blue economy, with the green economy, in a way that the rest of the world can take us seriously. We're a small island developing state. We don't have a lot of natural resources. We have fabulous people who are trainable and are highly sophisticated because Bahamians travel, and so they know what it's like to drive on a decent road and to get good service. We've been exposed to that. So why can't we do it? Why can't we deliver that same level of productivity within our shores? And I think we can do it by motivating people with the right incentives. And sometimes the right incentives is just about being proud to be a Bahamian. What does that mean? Do we know what that means anymore?
But is that really the case, though? Because in my experience, Bahamians are extremely proud, very, very proud of their country. So if that was that type of a change, I think you would have a lot more of it already. Isn't it really?
No, that's not all. That can't be all. I also preface by saying we need to have clear policies. So, for example, most countries today have a very clear strategy about electric mobility and renewable energy and their net carbon targets, right? Net zero targets. I couldn't tell you today what the government policy is on electric mobility or are achieving net zero or our renewable energy target. What is it? 30% by X date? I don't know what it is. Mm-hmm. But to have something clear gives investors an idea. Oh, I see they're going to be doing it. They're going to, by 2040, in, let's say in Europe right now, by 2040, I think that's the date, maybe earlier, no more internal combustible engine cars will be anywhere in Europe. What does that mean? That means that everybody's going to be driving an electric car. Why? Because it's better for the environment. And so they announce that early so that if I'm a car dealer, if I'm a car manufacturer, if I'm a car owner, I can start to prepare for 2040, right? I don't want to, you know, all of a sudden in 2039, the government announces, by the way, no more internal combustible engines. Well, I don't have the resources to invest in electric vehicles.
Yeah. Definitely, we need
that's
to be ahead
what I
of
call
it.
A
we have a caller.
Not
to break you too much. We have a caller on the line. Just want to respect the fact that they're calling in. Caller, go ahead, and we'll come right back to your point. Go ahead. You're listening to The Essentials and our guest, Miss Therese Turner Jones.
Yes, thank you, and good evening.
Good evening.
I love the conversation. I decided to call after the reminder of the times when Grand Bahama was taking care of the pharmaceutical matters. Mm-hmm. I want to believe that might have been in the 80s, I think. And the following conversation beyond that point about the different economies, not just the orange, the blue, the green, and so on and so forth. And all of this stuff seemed very forward-thinking and positive, dealing with efficiency and effectiveness, because I wanted to ask who was the guest, you know? And I want to know how we can actually have such persons involved in public planning so that we not only just look at to what is not there to change.
Okay. Well, the guest is Miss Therese Turner Jones. She's an economist. She has worked at the IMF. She has worked as a head for the IDB, marshaling a number of countries in the Caribbean. Very knowledgeable. And this is the reason why we're here. We're very discriminating in who we invite to the show. And, you know, part of these conversations, I'm not able to have a conversation, sit down with a prime minister or sit down with any policymaker for that matter. And so we use these as a basis to share ideas. And so, you know, we want to believe, as Ms. Turner Jones is speaking to at this point, we want to believe that the Bahamas has the potential and has created the foundation over the last 50 years to launch out to bigger things, but needs to really think more creatively, more innovatively, more positively, to be very clear in terms of the policies which are going to be impacted over the next 5 years, over the next 10 years, over the next 15 years. And so, to like these, with persons who are well-learned, like our current guests, may impact the airwaves and may get into the hearing of persons who can make the difference. You know, we would be proud of that. And so we certainly are glad that you are listening. The question I would have for you is, in remembering the Freeport, the A-Day, the Magic City, what do you think, very quickly, was the thing that went away which caused it to no longer be that magic city?
Well, I don't really have the answers as such, but I do know it's regrettable that it is not the way it was.
Yes.
Or it did not progress. It didn't move on.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping that if we can put all differences aside,
mm-hmm.
and even if we need to volunteer and to, as it were, put our money where our mouth is,
mm-hmm.
start off with local investment, not necessarily public investment, not necessarily investment coming from the government per se,
mm-hmm.
but investment from private, putting their money into the some of the things that were mentioned, manufacturing and all these other things that can make Grand Bahama the hub, the innovative hub, the hub of productivity, goods and services, goods beyond services, because tourism is primarily service.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We do have a container port and the shipyard and all these other things, but I think education was mentioned. The university, tertiary education, you know, the high end is as a niche.
Yeah. At the end of the day, there's more that can be done. There's more that should be done, and it needs to be innovative.
I want to also stress the volunteering part. The reason why I'm stressing the volunteering part, persons like myself, yourself, when we see decay, we can also go in and pitch in. I want to make a clarion call to ask persons to go into the schools just to encourage some of our young people who may be, as it were, going astray in terms of the conduct, behavior, and, you know, they, as it were, the seeing things early, just perhaps seeing that dollars need, I need to make dollars, I need to make money,
mm-hmm.
and I may do it the wrong way, but rather than think, so we can think of a national way of doing things. I want to leave quickly on Lois's last point, in the pride of being Bahamian and respecting the Bahamas. Now, I want to give a quick example. My flag fell off my car, my Bahamian flag. I stopped to pick it up, and another car behind me drove over the flag, rolled over the flag.
Oh.
Okay.
Yeah. It was not just like an
ordinary old car, a nice decent car. Saw someone coming to retrieve the flag that was fell on the road, drove over the flag. So.
Unfortunate. I get your point loud and clear. Okay. That should not have happened. Calling in, and then we go right back over to you, Ms. Jones. The point you were making.
Before we broke the segment, mm-hmm. and I thank the caller for his comments, and he hit a nail on the head.
Definitely.
I think retired people want to give back. They have time to give back. I can think about an uncle of mine who recently passed away, but he had volunteered in a school in Nassau, and those children really are children who need good models, role models. So if more people can find a way to give something of themselves back to the community, I think that would obtain some really good results in the country, because as we started out saying at the beginning of this show, you know, I happen to come from a family where the values were strong, the family was tight-knit, but I know, because I've seen over the years, that not everybody lives that way, and thankfully many families do, but we know that there are also families that where love is not present, and where encouragement is not present, and where children are not being nurtured in the way that we would like. So I think that's a really important point he made. Before, I know time is running.
Yeah, we haven't even brushed this. So obviously, you know, this conversation won't end. I think as we come to the point, maybe it's an important point here to take a break so that we can then use the rest of the show to kind of cast our minds towards the future. We're having a conversation with Ms. Therese Turner-Jones. She is an economist. She is an individual who is immensely experience. I've had the pleasure of being in a particular place and listening or reading her articulation on a number of issues. Totally impressed, not only by the fact that she's knowledgeable, but she's always, always fearless. Fearless in what she does and what she says. You're listening to The Essentials. Don't move. Come right back. We'll take a short break and we'll continue the conversation on the other side.
Next Level Solutions. We assist companies and organizations to understand and strategically resolve governance, risk, compliance, regulatory, finance, and operational challenges, maximize their performance, and grow. Next Level Solutions, a dynamic consultancy built on experiential knowledge. For further details on our service offerings, visit nlsolutionsbahamas.com or call 376-8951. Next Level Solutions. Practical solutions delivered.
Love the show? Want to give your support? Become a sponsor today. Call 302-2300 for our rates and packages. That's 302-2300. Become a sponsor on Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
And welcome back to The Essentials, The Reset. We are having a conversation with Miss Therese Jones, Turner Jones. And, you know, so far we have explored a number of areas. She has took us into discussion about sustainable the economy, considering some of the impact on Grand Bahama and how we can look to the future. And so before we get to her, we have a caller on the line, so let's take the call very quickly. And then when we get back to Ms. Turner, we want to cast our mind, what happens after the 50th celebration? Because the future beckons, and we have to plan and respond to that. Caller, go ahead very quickly. Caller, you are on The Essentials. No?
Good evening, Ms. Johnson, everybody. Mm-hmm. You did ask a question, Freeport lost.
Mm-hmm.
Remember Freeport was the hub back in the day. I was there back in the 80s, early 80s. And what I can remember is that all the guests would come off the cruise ship. They would even fly in, and the overnight guests, they were safe. In other words, Freeport was where the Americans wanted to be at the time. Everywhere they could go party, mm-hmm. and they stayed overnight. They had a fun time. I think that's what Freeport lost.
Okay.
Right there, the guests. We just need to get those overnight guests. back with us again, you know.
Thank you so much for that injection. So there's a loss of security. There's a loss and do what you have to do. So, Ms. Jones, let's come back to you. What would you say to us listening to you as to how we need to cast our mind for the Bahamas for the next 50 years? We have celebrated 50. There are many things to be celebrated, great achievements. What next?
So I think we have to, we started out by saying the great thing about having this inflection point at 50 is to be able to look back and say, okay, that worked, this didn't work. And by the way, here are the gaps. So I want to share a couple of gaps I see. And the first one, top of mind for me, is on gender. So a Bahamian woman is not able to pass on citizenship to her child if the father is foreign-born. I mean, this is just really an outdated, antiquated, very old-fashioned way of looking at women. If the Bahamas is serious about maintaining its talent, and by talent I mean keeping Bahamians in the Bahamas who study abroad and who may come back with a foreign spouse, and I can think of my niece who is living in Canada now, but who married a St. Lucian. You know, to think that if Gabrielle were to have Bahamian citizenship, that doesn't make any sense to me as a woman, and I think it's unfair, and that needs to be fixed. Second thing, violence against women and children in the Bahamas is escalating at a rate that is, I don't even know what to call it, but I think it's a crisis. And I support the women organizations right now in the Bahamas who are looking to get the legislation passed so that domestic violence in all of its forms is the best law and legislation we can have to protect women and children in the country. Third, our business model, our economic model has served us well for 50 years, but it probably won't serve us for the next 50 because, you know, like any product, products go through cycles. And we need to think about where is the Bahamas tourism product in terms of its business cycle. And I think what is the most jarring statistic of all in tourism is that we now have 1.5 million stopover visitors compared to 5 million sea visitors on an annual basis. That is just an insane statistic. Why is that an insane statistic? Because cruise visitors spend 10% of what a stayover visitor is going to spend. We spend more money on infrastructure for cruise visitors than we do for what they are valued. And we need to really think about that. I look at the rankings of our cruise ports relative to other cruise ports around the world, and I am embarrassed that we are like number 17 in the world. That's not excellence. That's not excellence in a business that is supposed to be very important to the country. Let's fix that. Let's not overhype cruise visitors, because telling me 6 million cruise visitors came into the country, I would say as a minister of tourism, you know, where to take that number, because it makes no sense. What we need to have, if we're going to, I think is an insane number anyway for a population of 400,000, we need people staying in hotels, people who are investing in second homes in the country, people who are willing to go to the family islands to buy a second home and to use those investments to really build out the infrastructure we need on the family islands. That's to deal with tourism. But more importantly, I think our economic model needs to be stretched, include technology and innovation and what we just discussed around Grand Bahama. It could be Grand Bahama. It could also be Long Island. It doesn't have to be Grand Bahama. But Grand Bahama currently has the infrastructure ready, and it'll be easier to do it there. The population is larger. It has an international airport, and a new one is going to be rebuilt. So I think that's a ready model. The fear I have with Grand Bahama, though, has to do with the hurricanes and the climate disasters, and whether we can build Grand Bahama in a way that will really protect it from what we know is going to happen. And I think this is the biggest risk. And I think any investor looking at where to put down, you know, $50 million will think twice about the environmental impact of a storm, because we know it's coming. And what are we doing to mitigate the impact of a natural disaster in the future? I am very optimistic about young people in the Bahamas, because I see a lot of creativity. I see more entrepreneurship. I see young people who are willing to start a business, invest in their own businesses, and really take us to that next level. And this is what we need. But to in order to nurture them, we need an ecosystem where young entrepreneurs have access to mentors, have access to angel investors, have access to equity markets where they can have people invest in their businesses, because that's the only way they will grow and they can expand to be something bigger than just a small business. And then lastly, I think on our human capital, we need a lot of investment in education. Our educational model is still very much, how would I say, baked in a 50-year-old model where we are creaming off the elite and we're leaving a lot of people behind, and children are coming out of high school being very innumerate and very illiterate and not able to do much except take instructions from people and make up beds in hotels. Mm-hmm. That has to change. And that can change by investing in the infrastructure of schools, taking different approaches. Our pedagogy has very much been, you know, dictate to children and they, you know, tell us back what it is that they're learning from us. But what we need to be doing is unleashing their brains in a way that they can think critically, analyze problems, solve problems, be creative and all that. And that comes when we expose children to the arts, to music, to, you know, athletic activities where we're developing the whole child and not just one part of the child. Bahamians are some of the kindest, most compassionate people I know on this earth. And that's something we have to nurture, because societies, when they start to deteriorate, what happens is, you know, we become tribal, we become very mean, we become coarse, we stop respecting our elders, we abuse children and we mistreat women, and we don't treat minorities in our midst with respect. And I think all of these what I call goals for the future are entirely doable if we pull together as a country. And this is not a partisan endeavor I think every Bahamian can buy into. We ask of our politicians and our policymakers to listen to the population, to listen to the women who are demanding change, demanding a safe house for women who are being abused, get that legislation passed, treat women as equals. And I'm going to say something very controversial here.
Yeah, we are kind of running clean out of time. So
running out of time. Okay, let me leave the controversial part out. But yes, we need to be careful who is running the agenda. A national policy agenda has to be a national policy agenda, and it shouldn't be hijacked by special interest groups. Definitely. And I say that because I think in some areas like fossil fuel policy and our renewable energy policy and our other kinds of policies, there's always a hidden agenda by vested interests. But I'm very optimistic, and I look forward to seeing that Human Development Index even grow higher. You know, I think we're now at 8.81, and you know, we're moving our way to the highest level, and that would be great. Thank you, Hubert, for having me.
Okay,
tonight.
Certainly a pleasure. It's my pleasure to have you. At some point in time, we'll have to revisit some of these conversations and expand on some of these other issues. So you've been listening to The Essentials, The Reset, and Therese Turner-Jones, a Bahamian here from the Bahamas, right from here in the Bahamas. She's living in Jamaica, worked around the world, and she has given us a lot to think about, a lot to chew on, and a lot to chew on, especially for the future. All that is left to say is the way we always end. Do not allow your greatness to become a victim of your unwillingness to change. All that is left to say is walk good, be good, one love, and Ubuntu. Good night.
Thank you.
Rastaman and Christian show love in many ways.
And if we see someone who needs help, we turn our face. We need to show love and stop the hate. We need